From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Let's talk about Nicaragua this week, but I think if you do it in context with the other things that are going on in the region, it'll make more sense to folks. That, you know, we haven't really had to cover much in Nicaragua on an ongoing basis other than, you know, so-called good news, development, canals, things like this. And then all of a sudden, the last couple of weeks, an all-out assault by the right wing and the CIA, you can bet, trying to do a regime change operation there, big time.
Yeah, and perhaps you can help me along the way if I get stuck, Don, because the overall context is very, very clear. And over the last, what is it now, three, four years, really ever since 2015 when in Brazil they started the soft coup against Dilma Rousseff, the then president of Brazil, when Mauricio Macri won the elections in Argentina on completely false promises, which we can see now completely breaking down.
Right.
In terms of Argentina's prosperity and the well-being of its ordinary people in Argentina.
Right.
And even Bloomberg, I think, published a headline saying something along the lines of international stock markets shocked when Argentina raises its interest rates to 40%. And so, you know, and this is what we were talking about. We've been talking about this for years, ever since that election back in 2015.
Right. We were saying how long was it going to take before the people were in the streets? And they've pretty much been in the streets since December of 2015, but it's building now. You can see it's going to that's going somewhere.
Yeah. And even Sergio Massa, the kind of the classic social democrat sellout in Argentina, who opened the door for Macri, by dividing the opposition vote against Macri. And if Sergio Massa had said to his supporters, well, vote for Cristina, the candidate for Cristina's party, the Frente por Victoria, they'd have won and Macri would have lost by a mile. But Sergio Massa did the classic social democrat thing, held the door open for the right. Macri got in, and now the social democrats in Argentina are scrambling to try and cover up what they've done.
Right.
But anyway, and that's another story. I know it's more important now to talk about the overall context. And so what we've got is this overall context, and its current expressions are things like the imprisonment of Lula da Silva on completely spurious charges of corruption without a scintilla of evidence. Similar events progressing in Ecuador against, or that have progressed against the former vice president, Jorge Glass, and now the authorities there, with the complacent collaboration of President Lenin Moreno, they're trying to prepare a case also completely spurious against Rafael Correa. Mm-hmm. In Colombia, you've got this outrageous case of the prosecution of Jesus Sandrich, a key figure who made the peace process possible in Colombia, who now, in complete contravention of almost every single agreement of the components that make up the Colombian peace process, he now risks being extradited to the United States on the basis of zero evidence again.
Right. Yep.
So you have that whole process going on. You also have the process going on in Venezuela of attempts by the United States government and their regional allies to call into question the validity of the Venezuelan elections, but so far at least the opposition candidate Henry Falcon, who's likely to do very well, although he may not win against the incumbent president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, he's likely to do quite well. He is resisting calls by the US-dominated extreme right opposition, the Popular Will parties and the Justice First parties, to boycott the elections. And that it looks as though they're in Venezuela. We saw last year that people in Venezuela are less and less inclined to follow the completely discredited policies of the extreme right wing in Venezuela. And this will be relevant for our subsequent conversation about Nicaragua, Don.
Right.
But anyway, and so as a result of what's going on in Venezuela, the local allies of the United States, Brazil, Chile, currently under Brazil's government, under the current usurper president, Michel Temer, and Chile under its new right-wing president, Sebastián Piñera, right, again as a result of a divided left-wing vote. In Colombia, Juan Manuel Santos, who's and we know very well what Juan Manuel Santos is, kind of complete creature of the United States.
Yep.
In Paraguay, very shady elections, overshadowed by serious allegations of corruption. A new right-wing president to succeed Horacio Cartes has taken power. Yeah. Somebody with links to the previous Stroessner dictatorship.
Yeah, I mean, this is a successor to a successor of another coup, by the way, the soft coup, right, in Paraguay, right?
Right. But against that, you have what we've been talking about for a long time as well, for years as well, the fact that even these right-wing governments recognize the United States as an economic power in decline, and they're protecting their interests by hedging their bets, making new agreements with China. And so what you have there is, over on the Pacific coast of South America, you have Peru working very closely with one of the leading ALBA governments, the progressive bloc. ALBA is the progressive bloc made up of Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Bolivia, previously Ecuador. It's questionable if Ecuador will continue in ALBA, and some Caribbean island nations. But the fact that Bolivia is one of those progressive countries has just over the last week or so signed a very important agreement about to do with customs regulations and trade regulations between the two countries, facilitating the Intercontinental Railroad, which is going to be funded by China to the tune of billions and billions of dollars, and involves investment from even Western corporate capitalist interests, especially from Western Europe, but so far as I know, none from the United States, which is also very telling, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that process of the kind of, and I don't like using this word, but I'm kind of, if you like, the split personality, the schizophrenic kind of feelings of the South American elite in particular towards the United States. And, well, what are we going to do because the United States is going to fall through the cracks in the next few years, and we have to protect our interests. And so that means we need to strike a deal with the Chinese and with the rest of Asia. For example, South Korea, Thailand, Taiwan, all these countries, and Indonesia in particular, of course, which is a tremendous, it's one of the biggest powers in the Southeast Asia organization, ASEAN. So anyway, I know all that's going on, and so that dynamic is in conflict with the dynamic of increasing U.S. insistence on trying to recuperate its neocolonial dominance in South America, Central America, and the Caribbean. And so that's the overall context of what's going on here in Nicaragua.
Well, you have this also, I mean, a piece at Telesur that you wrote, for example, mentions that, you know, Gbagbo and Gaddafi in Libya. So, you know, the U.S. started recapturing, lost colonies or whatever during the Obama years in Africa also. And then there's been, of course, the affirmative moves across the Middle East, moving down the list of parties that included Syria and the pushback in Bahrain against the popular uprising there and yada, yada, yada. And even the forward activity into Ukraine. So this is, you know, the home turf here. You're seeing that phenomenon play out here as well. It's already been asserted around the globe, pretty much.
Yeah, very much so. And you can, and what's happening in Nicaragua is very much a reflection of all that. And just by accident, I've been interested in what's been happening on in Western and North Africa. And what's happening in Latin America is very similar to that. And what's happening in Western and North Africa? And the European Union, through its one of its two most important members, forget about the United Kingdom. Its two most important members are Germany and France. And so within Europe, Germany is the dominant power. But what is France's contribution to the European Union? Commerce. France's contribution to the European Union is its control over its, and also to a lesser extent the United Kingdom, but more importantly France, is its control over its former colonial territories,
right,
which comprise most of West and North Africa. That is the main, and apart from its own internal economy and that contribution to the European Union. And among the great hypocrisies of the European Union and the apologists for the European Union is their failure to recognize how France's the French neocolonial domination of Africa contributes to the overall global political power projected by the European Union.
Right.
It's tremendous hypocrisy. And what the French have done, I mean, why is Mali still one of the poorest countries in the world? And because it's a former French neo-colonial territory, and it remains under French neo-colonial control,
right,
especially after the attack against Libya. And that was one of the reasons for the attack against Libya, as you and I and many people have been arguing for ever since the NATO intervention against Libya. One of the main reasons that they intervened against Libya was because Libya was preventing or impeding the continued neo-colonial domination of West Africa and North Africa.
That's right.
And you can see that very closely, very clearly. So that the same phenomenon is happening now in Latin America. You have the former colonial power, the United States, the former imperialist power, imposing its policies on the rest of the region through its local elites. And so where are the countries where there's resistance to that? Any country that resists that is going to be a target for intervention of one kind or another.
Right.
So we see that in Cuba with the intensification of sanctions that had been superficially relaxed under President Obama, but in an attempt to use a different modality. And now Trump and his administration have returned to the previous set of policies that Obama correctly identified as having completely failed. Why they think they're going to work again in this current context, and only they can kind of hallucinate, you know. And so the one fundamental thing from the international scene that we should apply to the role of the United States here in Latin America is that they are non-agreement capable. And nothing that people agree with the United States is worth the paper it's written on.
Right.
We can see that in what's happening vis-a-vis Iran. We can see that vis-a-vis the serial breaches of confidence by the United States in its relations with Russia. We know very well that the reason North Korea and South Korea are reaching a rapprochement is that China and Russia have intervened to try and promote denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. It's got nothing to do with the threats made by President Trump against the government and people of North Korea. And so and all that stuff that we've been talking about over the previous 10-15 minutes, and we need to use that as context to understand what's going on in Nicaragua. And one of the things that I find really quite depressing about any media coverage of what's been going on in Nicaragua is the level of ignorance, of historical ignorance, about this country and the Central American region in general. So what's the current situation in Nicaragua? Okay,
yeah.
So from April 19th to April 23rd,
yeah,
there were serious internal disturbances involving essentially cannon fodder, students being used as cannon fodder by the right-wing groups that are supported by the United States. And even now, minor disturbances continue, mainly promoted by paid delinquents, and who during that period of April 19th to April 23rd, it's very well established now that they were being paid by the political organizers of that of those disturbances, and $10 to $15 a day.
Right.
And so, what you see here on the news is constant denunciations by ordinary people in the barrios affected, in the urban districts affected, especially in Managua, where the main disturbances are centered, of gang activity, whereby gang members who have tried to associate themselves with the student protests, but who in fact have nothing to do with the student protests, and they're charging people, motorcyclists and motorists, they're taking money from them to allow them to pass through their barricades in these areas. Now for the moment, the Nicaraguan police haven't taken action about that. Mm. But I have the feeling, I might be completely wrong about this, but my feeling is that the authorities are letting that happen
right.
for the moment, partly because they're stretched very thin in terms of their police resources trying to provide security across Managua, which is a very sprawling urban area.
Right.
And nor do they want to give the political opposition a pretext for saying, oh, more government repression.
Yeah, you know, this is something that I noticed in the Soviet Union and also in Libya when I visited those places. And that is, for some reason, in all these police states, you can never find a cop when you need one. You know, you walk around New York City, you got five in your back pocket carrying machine guns and stuff. But this isn't the police state. In Libya, where, you know, you can't cross the street on the shore road because there's no police. There's like, you know, two cops for all of Libya or whatever. That's a police state. The United States is something else. So it's the same thing. Let me just recap this a bit. I mean, you had between the 19th and the 23rd thereabouts of April, this just passed, all of a sudden, simultaneously, riots sprung up with students making demands around the same, basically, there was a piece of legislation, two pieces of legislation that dealt with pensions. Not exactly what students generally preoccupy themselves with, which is something on the other end of their careers, but about pensions, that there were Molotov cocktail kits available across the country, basically, in each of these uprisings, or whatever you want to call them, basically each of these riots, which happened in a coordinate way over a three-day period. That while that happens, you start seeing these other steps come in. In other words, it's a playbook that somebody was running, and somebody had clearly organized.
Yeah, and so we go back to the Maidan in Kiev. We go back to the events in Caracas in 2002, in both cases, and also in Syria in Daraa, or Libya in Benghazi, back in 2011. In all those cases, people were there were deaths that were attributed to the government, but in the context of very, very serious public order disturbances. And if you look at how does the United States deal with public order disturbances, you know, and do they send their police out offering people kind of flowers?
Yeah, you know, right.
Like that, it's just the level of hypocrisy involved is tremendous. But the fundamental thing here is that the government immediately, rather than as what happened in Libya and Syria, in particular, and perhaps to some extent in the Ukraine, rather than kind of doubling down on efforts to defend public order, they simply said, "All right, well, we'll withdraw the issue, the pension reform that was which is supposedly the issue that triggered these riots,
right,
and these protests, and we're open for dialogue. So let's talk."
Right.
And so that's where Nicaragua is now. But and if you so you had this intense period of severe public order disturbances in which people were killed. And I've seen estimates of 45 or 60 or up to 100 people killed. But and the really solid information that we have is that around 23 people were killed. And certainly it's likely or probable that the final death toll will be set somewhat higher. Yeah. But what we're finding and what has been coming to light over the last few days is that, for example, I know of at least three cases in which people who are figure in death lists put about by the opposition human rights organizations here, funded by the NATO countries of the European Union.
Right.
Three of those people have appeared on Facebook saying, "We're not dead. We don't understand why we're appearing in these death lists, and this is right. extremely upsetting for our families. So please stop it."
Right.
And then yeah. you have another. We had another family over the last week, whose son died of a heart attack, completely unrelated to the student protests, and he too appeared in the list of protesters killed by the police. And so you have this kind of persistent, consistent disinformation appearing in the social networks that subsequently gets revealed to be completely untrue. But and it's like that old saying, what's that saying? A lie is halfway around the world while the truth is still pulling on its pants.
Yeah.
You know, and so it doesn't matter. I mean, the fact that untruth is proved to be untrue, it already had its impact on public opinion and on general opinion. And so what we're likely to find is that while the final death toll as a result of these disturbances on both sides, police officers killed, a Sandinista activist killed, innocent, but I know of at least one person killed here in Esteli, who was a guy from the rural town of Palacaguina, and he was just caught up in as a bystander in the events of the Friday night that week, and he was killed. He had nothing to do with the protests. So you have bystanders, Sandinist activists, police, and you also have protesters that have been killed. And so it's completely unrealistic and false of the international corporate media, almost all alternative media in the Western world, to project an image that, you know, it was just blanket government repression and all the people dead were protesters. That's completely untrue.
Here's part of the problem, too, by the way. I don't think people have a full appreciation of this, but I remember experiencing this back in 2011 from, you know, inside the box. Like, you know, you see the effectiveness of certain foreign media that's produced in the English language in providing some, you know, missing elements of the narrative, like the true part. And, you know, with RT and Sputnik and CGTN and Telesur and, you know, Press TV and on, that one starts to mistakenly, lose sight of how much power is behind Western propaganda, which the aggregate of Western media outlets has somebody on the ground on just about every square inch of the planet, and many of the people that they're with, or they're embedded with, are actors in a lot of these things. And so, you know, that's not the case for, say, Press TV or RT, as, you know, as well-rounded as their staffs might be. You know, they're not the global hegemon. And so for somebody to try to figure out in Moscow or Mexico City or, you know, wherever their bureaus are, what's happening in some village in Nicaragua inside the news cycle, without reference to what the New York Times published or whatever. There's a curve, you know, that takes a while to get up to speed. And so I saw this. I remember scratching my head for 2 or 3 weeks dealing with Press TV and RT when the attacks on NATO, on Libya started by NATO, thinking to myself, what the hell are these people thinking? Are they right, insane? Yeah. Because I knew what was going on because I was talking to people there that I knew, and I had been there recently, and et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's just not the case for every one of these organizations regarding every spot on the planet. It's just there's a learning curve.
Yeah, which is another aspect of the power of Western media, right?
Exactly.
So anyway, why would the United States want to upset and disturb and overthrow the current government in Nicaragua? Well, because it's resisting the right. United States regional policy,
right?
They which don't is one of just destruction of the nation state,
right?
In the regions and subordination of sovereign nation states to the influence, especially U.S. corporate influence, of course, but also to facilitate U.S. corporate influence to the influence of U.S. institutions. So you have, in the case of El Salvador and Guatemala in particular, you have a case where the attorney generals of something like 4 or 5 United States states, you know, that compose the country of the United States, they are the ones that are calling the shots in terms of internal corruption and anti-crime investigations in those countries.
I know. I mean, look at the big picture stuff. You've got this attack takes place on Nicaragua while all of the other battles have been going on in Venezuela, in Brazil, and across the region. And now this push comes with the push. They start dismantling some of the architecture of unity and solidarity that's been assembled in the last 20 years. For example, UNASUR. Like one of the biggest achievements, a regional, self-directed group of the states in the Western Hemisphere, excluding the United States and Canada, and now it's broken in half. Broken in half. Yeah, who would have thought that possible a year ago?
Yeah, and of course that leads to a resurgence of the Organization of American States, which is completely under the thumb of the U.S. State Department and the U.S. government.
Which was the point of doing it in the first place. There were centers of power that had developed and coalesced, beginning in earnest with the with Chavez and the experiment that he set in motion in 1999 and onward, at have been public enemy number one for the United States ever since. They jumped in early on with the coup in 2002, and woe to those who undertook that project. The people themselves turned it around in 48 hours. This must have been the most frightening thing that they'd witnessed in this hemisphere since the Haitian Revolution in 1802 or 1804 or whatever. And so they have been furiously tracking this project ever since, even as China has been designing canals and transcontinental railroads in conjunction with the people of the region for the next 100 years worth of economic activity. And that's this whole thing, we're seeing in earnest the United States go into battle to try to regain its territories. And we're going to see, I guess, as it plays out, whether or not that happens. And we got to stop here because we're out of time, Tony.
Oh, I'm sorry, Don, because there are a couple of things, important things to say about Nicaragua. Never mind, maybe next week.
Yeah, we'll pick it up later this week, I think, because we have a lot to cover that we haven't touched yet. So thank you very much for your time, as always. And
you're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks. Take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.